So have I already talked about slide 30?
Okay, that, which is the end, really. The only reason I'm bringing this back up is to show you that there is one more slide. Some of these chapters have an end of chapter summary table. I never read those to you because you can read the table yourself. I've covered this stuff. I just keep them in the slideshow because they can be handy things to study with. So that brings us to the next chapter, which is a tour of the cell, meaning we are going to survey the major components of cells. Before we get into that, though, the opening slide here shows you where typical cells are in this range of sizes. Now, this is an enormous range of sizes because this is a logarithmic scale, so every step is 10 times bigger than the other. Notice it goes from the size of atoms, a fraction of a nanometer, up to 10 meters, and 10 meters isn't even big enough to include all of life, right? Some trees are even bigger than that. But anyway, although there is some range in the size of cells, most cells are up, there's not a huge range. Most cells are just a little bit too small to see with the naked eye, which is why they are viewed with a light microscope, which we'll be using later today. Electron microscopes also exist, and they allow us to see much smaller things than light microscopes do. But anyway, we're in the microscopic realm, really, for most of this class, because it's cellular biology. Let's go to 2, though, and start looking at cells. Here we have a representative from one of the two cell types in the dichotomy. What is the dichotomy I'm talking about? Well, that is a dichotomy that I've talked about, but right. The dichotomy of cell types, not organism types, is prokaryotic cell and eukaryotic cell. Here we're looking at a prokaryotic cell, which were the original cells, and they've always been most cells. For a while, they were all cells. For most of life's history, they were all cells, the only ones that existed. Eukaryotic cells eventually came on the scene, but they've always been vastly outnumbered by prokaryotic cells. Prokaryotic cells, as we've talked about, are simpler structurally because they don't have membrane-bounded organelles. That means they are not subcompartmentalized because they have just one membrane, the plasma membrane that every cell has to have in order to be a membrane. That's one of these colors of yellow they decided to use here. And so everything within that is collectively called the cytosol. There is, of course, no true nucleus or any other membrane-bounded organelles. So that's a big difference between that and a eukaryotic cell, as we've talked about. But in a eukaryotic cell, the nucleus is where you find the DNA. Well, the fact that there's no nucleus in a prokaryotic cell doesn't mean there's no DNA. Cells need DNA whether they're prokaryotic or eukaryotic. It's just that in a prokaryotic cell, the DNA is in the only compartment that exists. The cytoplasm includes the DNA and all the other stuff that's in the cell. Even though it's not a separate compartment because there's no true nucleus, the DNA is kind of condensed into one region in that cytoplasm, which is why it's called the nucleoid, which is not a nucleus. It literally means like a nucleus. The oid suffix means like. Humanoid, for instance. So don't confuse a nucleoid and a nucleus. Now, this is kind of a catch-all picture because not all prokaryotic cells have all of these features. But typically, a prokaryotic cell, in addition to the plasma membrane that it has to have to be a cell, it will have a much thicker and stronger covering outside of that plasma membrane, which is called a cell wall. And there might be, not necessarily, but there might be on that cell wall several projections called fimbriae, and those allow the cell to anchor itself to something, like your tonsil, for instance, or any other substrate. There are ribosomes inside the cell, as you see labeled here. Ribosomes are organelles, and we'll talk much more about them later. But this doesn't violate what I've said about prokaryotic cells, because ribosomes are not membrane-bounded organelles. They're just little molecular machines that are not enclosed by their own membrane. So all cells have them, including prokaryotic cells. The capsule, if it's there, which is not always there, is like a slimy coating on top of the, or superficial to the cell wall. And this one happens to have flagella as well, which not all cells have. Flagella is the plural of flagellum, which is a whip-like projection. And it moves and pushes on the medium in which the cell lives, like the liquid in which this thing is living in, just like the propeller of a boat or a submarine pushes on the medium, the water, propels the cell through the medium. All right. Three. The cartoon down here, this is a real picture in the top, but the cartoon is easier to look at. And what you see here is just a little piece of the overall plasma membrane. We've talked about this as well before, too, because I mentioned in a previous chapter that any plasma membrane of any cell that's ever existed is chiefly made up of phospholipids, which is why they are entirely indispensable molecules for life. Can't have an organism without phospholipids. Each individual phospholipid is just one of these head with two tail figures. And why is it that they assemble automatically into a bilayer, a phospholipid bilayer? Right, they are amphipathic, which means that that molecule has a polar part and a nonpolar part on the same molecule. And so they assemble into the phospholipid bilayer because the tails, which are almost hydrocarbons, that's nothing but carbons and hydrogens, are therefore nonpolar, and they are therefore hydrophobic. They don't want to be around polar things, including water. So they're trying to hide from the water by putting the tails toward the interior thickness of the bilayer. Each individual layer is called a monolayer, but the tail-to-tail arrangement ensures that water is in indirect contact with these hydrophobic tails. The heads like being around the water, so the heads are either in direct contact with the exterior water or the interior water. I mentioned all that before in a previous chapter, but importantly, here we see that a lipid bilayer will form with no life, as I said. You could just put a sample of phospholipids into pure water, and you'll get a cell-looking thing, which will be a bag made out purely of phospholipid bilayer. But that can't be a living cell. A plasma membrane, which is the membrane of a living cell, has to have other things besides phospholipids in there. And chief among those other things are proteins of various kinds, which are these purple things. A major reason why a cell can't have just phospholipids in its plasma membrane is that in order to remain alive, a cell has to continuously exchange materials with its surroundings. It has to bring certain things into the cell. It has to get rid of certain things, or it will die. And some things can get through the plasma membrane for chemical reasons, because they have the right properties, but other things can't. And many of those things that can't are things that the cell needs to get through the membrane. And that's one of several reasons why proteins that are part of the membrane are there. They allow things into or out of the cell. By the way, this picture of these proteins brings up the difference I mentioned early on about the difference in the phrase. The phrase is membrane bound and membrane bounded. Remember I talked about this? A membrane bounded organelle is enclosed by its own membrane. Well, these proteins are membrane bound. They are tied to a membrane. They are part of a membrane, not surrounded by their own membranes. All right, now to four. In the opening slide, I said that there isn't all that much range in sizes of cells. There are some, you know, there is some range. For instance, a typical prokaryotic cell is only about 1/10 as big in each of the three dimensions as a typical eukaryotic cell. And there are some that are smaller than that and some that are larger than the typical eukaryotic cell. For instance, frog eggs, which are single cells, are actually visible to the human eye. But most are in a pretty tight range. There's not all that much range. And there's a good reason for that, which is what's illustrated in slide four. You know, you all started out, well, I did too, as a single cell, right? You started out as a zygote, which was created by the fusion of your parents' gametes. An egg and a sperm got together. So you started out as one cell, microscopically big, invisibly small, I mean. And now you're huge as far as most organisms are concerned. There's things that are bigger than we are, but we are huge compared to most organisms in the world. But you're not just an adult-sized cell. You didn't grow up by that one cell you started out as becoming the size of an adult human. And that's because that would be impossible. The point I'm trying to make is that to remain alive, a cell cannot grow indefinitely in all three dimensions. And that's because of a constraint that's put on how big a cell can get. And that constraint is called the surface area to volume ratio. Like any ratio, it is just a fraction, right? One number divided by another. So the surface area to volume ratio is simply the value of the surface area for the cell divided by the value for the volume of the cell. Most cells aren't perfect cubes, but it's easier to think about the math if we think of a cube. So this cube here with the one beside it represents a cell. Now, no units are shown here, notice. It's just one. The units actually don't matter to the concept. But anyway, this is a cell that is one by one by one. All right? What is the surface area? How would you compute the surface area of this cell? Well, it has six, since it's a cube, it has six flat faces, right? Each face is a square. And each square is one by one. So each face has an area of one square unit. But there are six of them. So that's why the overall surface area is six square units. All right? The volume, on the other hand, is three dimensions. So it's one by one by one, which is one cubic unit. That's where this one comes from. And therefore, the surface area to volume ratio is six divided by one, which is six. Now let's grow this cell in all three dimensions, meaning make it wider, make it deeper, make it taller, all at once. And we're making it five times as big in each of the three dimensions. That's this big cube. Well, when you do that, then every face has a surface area of 5 times 5, which is 25. But you have six of those, so that's 150 square units of area. Obviously, it got bigger, as you'd expect when it grew. The volume, though, is now 5 times 5 times 5, which is 125 cubic units of volume. And therefore, now the new surface area to volume ratio is 150 to 125, or divided by 125, which is only 1.2. In other words, the surface area to volume ratio goes down as a cell gets big in all three dimensions. And this makes perfect sense mathematically. Because area is a square function, right?
If we graph just the positive value numbers, the values for positive x,
area forms half of a parabola, right? Y equals x squared, but y equals x cubed gets big even faster than y equals x squared does. In other words, volume, as the cell gets big in all three dimensions, the volume will grow and the surface area will grow, but the volume will grow a lot bigger than the surface area will. And eventually, the surface area will not be enough to allow enough exchange with that much bigger volume that you have. This is why cells don't get indefinitely big. Now, there are some extraordinarily long cells. A cell can be big in one dimension as long as you keep the other dimension small, because then you still have a small volume, like a neuron in your body, for instance. A single cell goes from the base of your spinal cord all the way to your toe. That's a very, very long cell, but it's still microscopically small in its width and depth. Only the length is long. So it still has a high surface area to volume ratio.
Well, the point that's made on this third column here is that you didn't grow up to be an adult-sized single cell. Instead, organisms like us get big by making our bodies out of multiple cells, each of which is small. So this cube on the right represents a multicellular organ that has the same size as this big one 5x5x5 cell. But since it's made up of a bunch of 1x1x1 cells, the total surface area to volume ratio is still 6. Each individual cell has enough membrane to allow things in and out of it to service that volume that it has.
Now to 5. And it takes me a little bit of time to get through 5, but then it'll speed up after that. 5 is another catch-all picture, meaning that not every cell will have every one of these features. But we're looking now at a eukaryotic cell. And more specifically, we're looking at an animal cell in this picture. There are other kinds of eukaryotes besides us animals, of course, but we're starting with an animal cell. And obviously the coloration is just, that's not really the colors that these things are. They're just, it's just there to make it easier to look at and talk about. But let's start with the conspicuous purple nucleus. It shouldn't surprise you that there's a nucleus, because we're talking about an animal, which is a eukaryotic cell. And so the nucleus is just an example of a membrane-bounded organelle. It's not the only one. It's the basis for the name eukaryote. But remember, eukaryotes have not only a membrane-bounded nucleus, but they also have other membrane-bounded organelles, unlike prokaryotes. So the nucleus is the first membrane-bounded organelle we'll talk about in this picture. And there are going to be several membrane-bounded organelles I'll talk about, but three of those membrane-bounded organelles are actually multiply membrane-bounded. The nucleus is the first example of that. I don't know whether you can see it depending on where you're sitting, but not only is there a membrane covering the nucleus, there's actually two membranes. Each layer here is its own phospholipid bilayer. So there's two phospholipid layers, and then there's another two phospholipid layers. So the covering of the nucleus is a double membrane, and it's collectively called the nuclear envelope, meaning both of those membranes together are called the nuclear envelope. It's a cutaway view of the nucleus, but you can see some of the surface of the nuclear envelope, and here and there you see that there are these pink complexes. Those are protein complexes that are embedded in the membrane, but they're arranged in such a way that they make a tunnel. So they make up what are called nuclear pores. Nuclear pores are important because things have to get through the nuclear envelope, in or out. We've already talked a little bit about that in the previous chapter when I had that slide discussing transcription and translation. In a eukaryotic transcription for any cell occurs where the DNA is because it involves DNA. But for a eukaryotic cell, that's in the nucleus. Translation occurs where the ribosomes are, which for a eukaryotic cell is out in the cytoplasm. So the mRNA that gets produced in the nucleus, because that's where the DNA is, that mRNA then, before it can be used as a code for how to actually build the protein, has to exit the nucleus, and it gets out through these nuclear pores. Inside the nucleus, there is, of course, DNA. We've already talked about that. But it's not just naked DNA, meaning DNA as its own molecule and that's it. DNA is complexed with a bunch of proteins. And we'll talk about them later, but they're called histones. And the combination of these histone proteins and the DNA is a mixture that we call chromatin. That's why this is labeled here. Chromatin is the material that chromosomes are made of. You're much more likely to have already heard of chromosomes than of chromatin. Well, chromatin is the stuff that makes up chromosomes. And that's in the nucleus. Now, don't be confused by this dark region that's labeled nucleolus. I mean, don't confuse that word with nucleus. It's very similar. The nucleolus is just part of the nuclear contents. It's part of the nucleus. Specifically, the nucleolus is there to produce kinds of RNA other than mRNA. I've only mentioned mRNA so far, but there's all kinds of different RNA types. We'll talk about them later. Well, they're made at the nucleolus. Okay. The outer membrane of the nuclear envelope, this superficial purple layer, notice that here and there it folds outward, and in this cartoon version becomes blue, like right here. So it's the same membrane, it's continuous, but as soon as it folds out and wraps around into this blue stuff, it's no longer considered to be the nucleus. It's connected to it. It's continuous membrane material. But when they start coloring it blue here, all of this blue stuff is a separate membrane-bounded organelle called collectively the endoplasmic reticulum, or ER. And it is one organelle, the endoplasmic reticulum, but there are two functionally and structurally distinct components of it, which are called the rough and smooth endoplasmic reticulum. The rough endoplasmic reticulum is all of this stuff that kind of looks like flattened pancakes. And the reason that it is called rough is because when you look at it under a light microscope, it has a roughness, kind of like sandpaper appearance to it, because of all these little brown dots that you see on it. Well, the brown dots are their own organelles. Those are ribosomes, just like we looked at in that prokaryotic cell slide. But these ribosomes happen to be, at the moment, studding the surface of the endoplasmic reticulum, or that part of it, which is why that part of the ER is called the rough ER. The smooth ER not only doesn't have these ribosomes attached to it, so it doesn't have that roughness, but also it's more of a tube-like arrangement than flat pancakes or sacs. It's more of a tube-like. Well, these things don't only look different, these two parts of the ER, that is, they also function differently, and that's why they look different. The primary job of the rough endoplasmic reticulum is to modify newly made polypeptides. So we haven't looked at the detail yet of translation, but I've told you already that translation is the process of actually assembling a polypeptide using the instructions that's in mRNA. And when you assemble a polypeptide, really what you're doing is producing the primary structure, right? Which is simply the sequence of amino acids that makes up the polypeptide. When that is a brand new polypeptide, it has not yet folded up into its shape that it needs to assume in order to do whatever function it performs. Well, for some polypeptides, as soon as they're made, they're not yet ready to operate. Some of them need to be modified in one way or another, and how they're modified depends on the particular polypeptide. But since those modifications are made after you build the sequence, we call that post-translational modification, because it occurs after translation. This doesn't occur for all polypeptides, but does for many. And the job of the endoplasmic reticulum is to receive those brand new polypeptides that do need to be modified, which is why all of these ribosomes are there. These ribosomes are the machines building these brand new polypeptides, and they're associated with the ER membrane so that these brand new polypeptides are strung into, you know, as the coming off the assembly line, they're strung into the hollow interior. And a word that means hollow interior is lumen. These brand new polypeptides are put into the lumen of the rough endoplasmic reticulum. The rough endoplasmic reticulum then figures out what kind of modification needs to be done to each of these polypeptides and performs the modification. That explains the roughness, because the ribosomes are actually producing the polypeptides. The ER is receiving them. The primary job of the smooth endoplasmic reticulum is to produce lipids. But it's also important for storage of various things, including calcium ions, especially in your skeletal muscles. Calcium ions, when they're out in the general cytosol, which is the liquid component of the cytoplasm, they lead to muscular contraction. So when you're not intending to contract that muscle, when you want it to rest, those calcium ions are pumped into the lumen of the smooth ER to keep them out of the general cytosol. But then when you intend to contract the muscle, they'll be released, and that will bring about events that cause the contraction. All right, all the blue stuff is one endoplasmic reticulum. If it weren't for the coloration, then this teal-colored one here would be easily mistaken for just more rough endoplasmic reticulum. Very similar in appearance. It's flattened sacs made out of membrane. It is its own membrane. I mean, it's its own organelle, though. And as you see, it's labeled as Golgi apparatus. That's what some books will call it. Some books will call it the Golgi body, or I mean, the Golgi. But Golgi is just some dead Italian that it's named after. Anyway, the fact that it looks so similar to the rough endoplasmic reticulum brings up the important point that membrane material is membrane material. So it's the same stuff basically making up the membrane of all of these membrane-bounded organelles, as well as the plasma membrane. It's all the same material basically, mostly phospholipids, but also proteins and other things in there as well. And not only is it made of the same stuff, pieces of membrane are continuously moving around from organelle to organelle. And that is true right away with the Golgi apparatus. The main job of the Golgi apparatus, which can also be called Golgi complex, is to operate more or less as a receiving and shipping center. If you have a factory, for instance, or some big business, there's a receiving center somewhere in the on the building, there's a shipping center. The receiving is where trucks bring things to that place. The shipping center is where trucks come and pick things up to take it away. That's what the Golgi apparatus really does. And what it receives in its receiving end is packages that contain the now just recently modified polypeptides that were modified by the Golgi by the rough endoplasmic reticulum that we just talked about. The rough endoplasmic reticulum, after it modifies its proteins appropriately, will package them, these newly modified proteins, into a little bag of membrane. And the membrane comes from the rough endoplasmic reticulum itself. So it's this blue stuff. A little piece will pinch off and become what's called a vesicle. We have vesicles. These little spheres are vesicles of various sorts. But the vesicle will hold that package of newly modified proteins, and that will be sent to the nearby Golgi complex to receive that vesicle. But since the vesicle is made out of membrane material, it's the same stuff as the membrane that makes up the Golgi complex, so it basically just melds into the membrane of the next organelle. Kind of like oil droplets on water that are separate at first, but when they contact each other, it will coalesce into one bigger droplet. So that's how the Golgi complex receives its packages, as little vesicles made out of membrane material from the rough endoplasmic reticulum. That will put these modified proteins into the Golgi complex's lumen, and it's the job of the Golgi to figure out where these new proteins, now modified, need to go in order to do their job. Some proteins need to be fully exported, meaning all the way out of the cell so that they can work outside a cell, become part of the extracellular material. Others need to be embedded in the plasma membrane itself, because the plasma membrane, remember, is studded with a bunch of proteins. Membrane-bound proteins are proteins that are in the plasma membrane. Well, the reason they get there is because the Golgi sends them there. So not only are vesicles used, pinched off of the rough ER to send those vesicles to the Golgi complex, but on the other end of the Golgi, which is the part that's away from the ER, new vesicles will bud off of the Golgi using its membrane to send a vesicle to its proper destination. And that's the shipping aspect of the Golgi. Okay, let's just keep working clockwise on these labels. Lysosome is the next thing labeled. The zome part of this word, as in soma, means body. And lysis, as we've already talked about, means splitting, right? Like in hydrolysis. Well, lysosome, therefore, means splitting body. It's a specialized, small, membrane-bounded organelle that looks just like a vesicle. And really, it is a vesicle, but it's a vesicle that serves as its own organelle with a specific function. The reason it's called a lysosome is that it is a little bag of membrane in which hydrolysis, splitting of bigger molecules into smaller ones, occurs. Now, doing that, as I've already mentioned, but that we'll look at the details more later, requires enzymes. Just about any chemical reaction in a cell requires the help of an enzyme. But there are specific enzymes whose job it is to speed up specific hydrolysis reactions, and we therefore call those hydrolytic enzymes. Well, a hydrolytic enzyme is a dangerous thing to have around. Yes, you want them to work on whatever you're trying to split apart, but they could also split apart things that you don't want to be split apart. So you don't want to have these hydrolytic enzymes in the general cytosol where they can damage things that you don't want to split apart. That's why the hydrolysis occurs safely inside a lysosome, keeping those dangerous enzymes away from the rest of the cell. Mitochondrion is the next label here. That's the singular. Mitochondria is the plural. And there's a couple shown here. These orangish bean-shaped things are mitochondria. And this is the second example of a multiply membrane-bounded organelle. The nucleus was the first that I mentioned. A mitochondrion is also multiply membrane-bounded. So there is an outer mitochondrial membrane and an inner mitochondrial membrane. And we'll look at it in greater detail in its own slide. I'll have more to say about the membranes. But for now, let me just give you the major function of mitochondria. A mitochondrion's major job is to perform a complex set of chemical reactions that we'll study in Unit 3, which collectively are called cellular respiration. And what that accomplishes is maximization of usable energy from fuel molecules. All right, now peroxisome, the bluish one, would be hard without any color to tell it apart from a lysosome because they're really both vesicles. They're just specialized for different reasons. A peroxisome gets its name because its job is to break down what collectively are called reactive oxygen species, or ROS as an acronym. ROS, reactive oxygen species, are byproducts of metabolism that can easily oxidize materials, and that can damage the materials that get oxidized. Among the ROS are various peroxides. This is why this thing is called a peroxisome. So we can't help making certain amount of reactive oxygen species, which are oxidizing agents, but we can deal with the fact that they accumulate, whether we want them to or not, by allowing certain enzymes in peroxisomes to deal with them safely. So this is exactly why antioxidants are such a big deal in dietary literature or in commercials, right? Antioxidants allow for ROS, reactive oxygen species, to be destroyed so that they don't damage other things in the cell. It's part of anti-aging. Okay, microvilli is a plural word. The singular is microvillus. Villus by itself is a word that means a finger-like projection. And so microvilli are just small finger-like projections. Each one of these is a microvillus. And not all cells have these. But this, like I said, this is a catch-all, so they're included here. A microvillus, though, is really important in increasing surface area to volume ratio. We just talked about surface area to volume ratio, right? Well, if you didn't have these microvilli, then the surface area would be, you know, consider this to be a perfect sphere, even though it isn't. It would be the surface area of a sphere. But when you have a microvillus, you are increasing surface without really adding to the volume very much by having these outfoldings of membrane. All right, you see that? So a lot more surface area than you would have if you didn't have the microvilli. And that would be appropriate in a cell that needs extra membrane. A perfect example in your body would be the cells that make up the endothelium, or the inner lining of your small intestine. Your small intestine is specialized for one of the major jobs of the digestive system, which is to absorb the molecules that are now small enough to enter your body. The molecules in food are way too big to get into cells. That's why you first have to digest them while they're still outside of your body, which is, you know, the contents of the digestive tract is really outside of your body. You're wrapped around that tube. So you break them down into small enough molecules, like you break fats down into glycerol and fatty acids. You break proteins down into amino acids. You break polysaccharides down into monosaccharides, all while they're still outside your body. Then those small molecules can be absorbed, meaning they can finally enter your body by going into the cells of your body. And the first cells they enter are the ones lining that stuff, which is where the small intestine meets the material. Well, doing that requires the help of proteins. Membrane-bound proteins in these cells serve as transporters to move these things from the gut lumen into your cells. And therefore, the more membrane you have, the more proteins you can house in those membranes, acting as transporters, because everything's moving through. And if you don't get them transported in time, it's going to be a waste, because it's just going to come out the other end. We've evolved over many generations to maximize the absorption of the food coming through as while it's there. So that's why you would have microvilli there, for instance. A next, in all caps, is cytoskeleton. But notice the colon here. The cytoskeleton includes three major categories of protein components: microfilaments, intermediate filaments, and microtubules. All three of those are proteins or protein complexes. All three of them together make up what is called the cytoskeleton. And the cytoskeleton is a framework, just like your bony endoskeleton is a framework. So it holds things in place. That's one major job. But also, especially when it comes to the microtubules, it allows for things to be moved from one place in a cell to another. You should never think of a cell as being a passive bag of stuff that just sloshes around. The contents of a cell is highly orchestrated. Things are where they are at the moment because the cell is trying to have that happen. They're not just randomly occurring in there. But anyway, these microtubules, which are just part of the cytoskeleton, serve as little roadways. We'll look at that again in a different slide. And we'll also compare the three kinds of protein filaments that make up the cytoskeleton. The T-shaped thing here in yellow looks like two pieces of licorice forming a T-shape. Those are not the centrosome, even though it looks like that's what it's pointing to. The two pieces of licorice are called centrioles. The centrosome, notice the bracket here, is really this yellow halo around the centrioles. So the centrioles are in the centrosome. The centrosome is a microtubule organizing center, which is why you see microtubules in yellow emanating from the centrosome. That's where they are built and get longer from. All right. Now, I wish I could tell you more about the centrioles, but we haven't really figured out what they do. All I can really tell you is that eukaryotic cells in general have a centrosome, but animal cells have centrioles in their centrosome. Plant cells and other kinds don't. Now, a major function of a centrosome, whether it's an animal cell or not, is when it comes to splitting the cell into two. process that we'll study later called mitosis. Mitosis and cytokinesis collectively, really. But mitosis, the part of cell division called mitosis, heavily involves what by then will be two centrosomes. We'll look at the details of that later. This cell happens to be flagellated. It has a flagellum. That's another example of something that not every cell is going to have, not every animal cell. Actually, not all that many animal cells have a flagellum, but what's a good example? Right, a sperm cell is one that has a flagellum, and that's because a flagellum is a locomotory device, which means it's there for the purpose of propelling the cell from point A to point B. And in terms of body lengths, lengths of the cell, thinking of the cell, the sperm as one body, it has a hell of a long swim if it has any hope of getting to an egg to fertilize it. So it needs a strong propeller. All right, I've mentioned all of those. So now we can finally go on to 6, which is a very similar picture. Except that in 6, we're looking at a plant cell instead of an animal cell. Now, there obviously are differences between plant cells and animal cells, but there's also a lot of similarities. And most of the things that I just discussed for the animal cell are also found in a plant cell for the same reason. They have the same functions. So I'm not going to cover all that again, but you know, you have much of the same labeling as you did in the previous slide. It's true for plant cells as well, and actually other eukaryotic organisms besides plants and animals. But there are some things that you find in plant cells that you don't find in animal cells. One important thing is the dark brown covering that we see here. So this yellow right here is the plasma membrane. Every cell has to have a plasma membrane. Well, for an animal cell, that's the only thing it has. It has a plasma membrane, has a covering, and that's it. So it's pretty flimsy. A plant cell has a flimsy plasma membrane, but exterior to that, it has a much thicker and much stronger cell wall, just like the picture of the prokaryotic cell I showed you earlier. And we'll discuss the importance of that a little bit, well, in lab eventually. But you find them in plant cells, you don't find them in animal cells. Another thing is this huge-looking central vacuole. Now, a vacuole is really just a big vesicle. It's made out of membrane material, so it's the same stuff. It's a bag. The name is kind of a misnomer because it's named for an empty bag. Vacuous means empty. A vacuum is emptiness. But it's not really empty. It just looks empty when you see it under a light microscope. What's in it is mostly water, but there can be other things in there as well, like, for instance, various pigments, depending on what kind of plant cell it is. A central vacuole can be used as a general waste dump, in a sense, too. Things that the plant doesn't want to be around, the parts that are in the cytosol, the main liquid compartment, it can put those things into the central vacuole just to get them away from everything else. The central vacuole, though, is also one reason why, compared to animals, plants can grow pretty quickly. If you consider, depends on the species, but a seedling overnight can get drastically taller, right? When it's just sprouting. Well, just like an animal, plants grow by adding new cells. They don't just have their cell get bigger. So they're adding more and more cells, whether it's an animal or a plant. Any multicellular organism grows by adding cells. But compared to animals, plant cells are a little bit easier to make in terms of materials because there's a little bit less to build because of the central vacuole. The central vacuole is mostly water. Well, you don't have to make water. Water comes from the soil. All it has to do is absorb it. And so that's why it can add cells more rapidly than an animal cell, or than an animal can. The other major thing that we see in plant cells that we don't see in any animal cells are these green organelles. Each one of these is a chloroplast, and chloroplast is the third of the three multiply membrane-bounded organelles that I'll mention. So nucleus was the first, mitochondrion second, chloroplast third. So they're just like the mitochondrion, a chloroplast has an outer membrane and an inner membrane. And we'll study these in greater detail in a bit as well, but for now let me just tell you that the major function of chloroplasts is a whole other complex set of reactions collectively called photosynthesis. And what photosynthesis accomplishes is production of organic compounds out of inorganic compounds. That's something that no animal is able to do. Not just animals. There's a whole, you know, ecologically speaking, there are two major kinds of organisms in the world. And those are called producers and consumers. Producers are the organisms that can produce organic materials starting with inorganic materials. No consumer can do that. All organisms have to have organic materials, which is why consumers require producers to exist. Otherwise, they can't, because they can't make their own organic compounds. They have to get those organic compounds already in organic form, either directly from a producer or indirectly. So in other words, consumers either eat producers, or they eat consumers that eat producers, or they eat consumers that eat consumers that eat producers. It always has to go back to producers. Well, producers, not all producers are eukaryotic, but eukaryotic producers include chloroplasts, and that allows for the photosynthesis that makes these organic compounds. Photosynthesis we'll look at in the same unit as cellular respiration. Notice, by the way, though, that a plant cell has both mitochondria and chloroplasts. So it can undergo photosynthesis and cellular respiration. We animals have just mitochondria, not chloroplasts also. Another thing that you don't find in animal cells, although there are similar things, just with different names, are these little tunnels that are labeled as plasmodesmata. That's also a plural. The singular is just plasmodesma. And these don't just look like little tunnels. They are little tunnels. They're examples of what are called intercellular junctions. Intercellular simply means between cells. So all of this dark brown material is cell wall. That's between this cell and the next cell. The yellow is the plasma membrane. And notice that the holes in the cell wall, which are the plasmodesmata, the tunnels, those are lined with membrane material that's continuous with the plasma membrane. So that means the plasma membrane here wraps into the next plasma membrane, and it's all really one compartment in an entire plant. A huge tree, yes, it's made of quadrillions of cells, but the interiors of those cells are all linked together by these little tunnels. So you could think of the whole plant as having one huge compartment within itself.
These plasmodesmata are passageways. They allow for communication between cells, meaning things can get through them from one cell to the other. It has to be the right kind of material to get through them, but that's what plasmodesmata are for. All right, those are the catch-all pictures. Now is where we can go through the slides a little more quickly, because for several slides, it's really just a close-up view of the things that I've already talked about, including slide 7. This is a view of not only the nucleus, but of the rough endoplasmic reticulum as well. The reason they're shown in one is because of what I was already talking about. They're really connected to each other. They share a membrane. So you can get a better view of the outfoldings that occur in the outer nuclear envelope, the outer membrane of the nuclear envelope. It will fold out and become part of the membrane of the rough endoplasmic reticulum. You also get a better view of the brown ribosomes that make the appearance look rough on the ER, and you get a better view of these pink nuclear pores. This is kind of like the tunnel itself is not a structure; it's just a hole. But it's the tunnel is kind of like the interior of a barrel, and a barrel's made up of a bunch of staves, right? Each little piece of wood is a stave. Well, in these nuclear pores, the staves are proteins that are in the membrane, and a bunch of them together make up more or less a barrel with a hollow interior. Slide 8 now looks at a cartoon version of a ribosome in much bigger view. They were just little dots before. They are truly tiny organelles, and they're not membrane-bounded. But this cartoon shows you the important fact that any given individual ribosome is really a two-part device. There's two subunits making it up, with the reasonable and descriptive names large subunit and small subunit. This kind of a lie, this cartoon, not only because it's a cartoon, but because the large and small subunits wouldn't actually be together unless that ribosome is busy making a polypeptide at the moment. So there's a whole bunch of large subunits and a whole bunch of small subunits. It doesn't matter which large subunit you choose and which small subunit you choose. They're all modular. So these two happen to get together, but they wouldn't stay together. They only come together, as we'll see later, when an mRNA comes along first. And when they clamp together, then they start the important process of translation. That's how the polypeptide itself is built, according to the instructions in that mRNA that has to be there. Well, another thing we see on this slide, though, is that you can classify ribosomes as free ribosomes or bound ribosomes. There is no difference as far as the makeup of the ribosomes. In fact, they are the same ribosomes, just in two different times. But the reason we use these words is that a free ribosome is not connected to a membrane. It is just in the cytosol, free, as you see in the electron micrograph here. A bound ribosome is bound or tied to a membrane at the moment. But all ribosomes, when they come together to become, when the subunits come together to become a ribosome, they all start out as free ribosomes. Some of them will remain free ribosomes and make polypeptides that don't need any help once they're made, and then the ribosome will break into two subunits again, never become a bound ribosome. Others, though, will start out as a free ribosome, and when the cell figures out this polypeptide that's beginning to be made by this free ribosome is one of these polypeptides that's going to need help, going to need modification. And that's why those ribosomes then become associated with the membrane of the endoplasmic reticulum. They become bound ribosomes.
So all those little brown dots you find on the, giving the roughness to the appearance of the rough ER, those are only temporarily there. Those happen to be the ribosomes there at the moment. And they'll detach and other new ones will come in. All right, that's 9 now that we're on. We've already talked about the membrane, so there's no new information up here at the top. But here you get a cartoon version of the fact that vesicles are formed simply by membrane material from an organelle budding off of the main part. So it just pinches off, now it's on its own. And if this is a this transport vesicle is coming from the rough ER, that means what it's the reason that it budded off is because it's now a little package carrying the now modified proteins that the rough ER just modified. And where is the transport vesicle headed? To the Golgi complex. But in the, just to use the color scheme, it's blue to show you that that membrane came from the ER. In the next slide, 10, we see it's still blue, but since it's made out of membrane, it will easily fuse with the teal-colored membrane made out of the same stuff that is part of the Golgi complex. And so it's now officially part of the Golgi, but the fusion of that vesicle will spill its contents into the lumen of the Golgi complex, and the contents is modified proteins. So this is a better view of the Golgi complex, and it shows you that it is a polar organelle. Now, this use of the word polar has nothing to do with charge. Polar simply means that there's two different ends, like North Pole and South Pole, for instance, of the globe. It's polar because there is one end that does the job of receiving and one end that does the job of shipping, as indicated by the red arrow. Well, the receiving end is the end of the Golgi that is in direct contact in those other slides with it's right up against the rough endoplasmic reticulum. That makes sense, right? That's where the packages are coming from. So the receiving end is called the cis face. The other end, which is away from the Golgi, away from the endoplasmic reticulum and closer to the plasma membrane, is the shipping center, the output from this organelle, and it is the trans face. So notice the same words as in geometric isomers that we talked about, a cis version and a trans version. Cis means same side, trans means across or other side. And that's the direction of travel of these materials through the Golgi. Golgi figures out where these proteins need to go, packages them in a new vesicle that's made out of membrane from the Golgi itself, which is why these vesicles are now teal colored, and that will go to the appropriate destination. Eleven. Speaking of vesicles, on the bottom left, we have a picture of an important process of that's used in a lot of cells called phagocytosis, as you see labeled here. Well, phagocytosis is just a specific example of a more general process called vesicular transport. And vesicular transport, as the name indicates, is transport using a vesicle. And by transport here, I'm talking about getting something either into or out of the cell. There's other ways to do that, but vesicular transport is one of the three. Okay, so that's the general term. Any transport into or out of a cell that uses a vesicle to get that thing into or out of the cell is called vesicular transport. There's two major categories of vesicular transport based on the direction in which things are traveling, either into or out of the cell. So if it's vesicular transport that brings something into the cell, we call it
endocytosis. Osis means condition, cyte means cell, endo means in. But if you export something using the using a vesicle, but just in the reverse direction, it's exocytosis. Well, endocytosis is always bringing something in. That's what makes it endocytosis. But that itself is broken into two categories, depending on what it is that's getting brought in. So the two kinds of endocytosis are phagocytosis and pinocytosis. Well, the phago part of that phagocytosis word, which is what we're seeing here on the A in the slide, means eat. So phagocytosis linguistically means cell eating, like the cell is eating solid chunks from the external environment. Like this food particle, whatever this brown thing is, that's a solid chunk of something. Tiny, it's a molecule, but it's a solid chunk. What happens, though, is that the cell will wrap part of its plasma membrane around that until it totally surrounds it and pinches off. And now this vesicle that's formed includes the particle that was outside of the cell. Now it's inside the cell. But notice that this brown thing never went through a membrane. So vesicular transport is a way to get things into or out of the cell without actually making those things pass through a plasma membrane. Pinocytosis is really the same process, but it means cell drinking. Pino means drinking. And the only difference is what kind of thing gets brought in. If it's a big chunk of something, it's phagocytosis, like food. If it's just taking a sip of the liquid exterior and bringing it in as a vesicle, that's pinocytosis, cell drinking. Now, on this phagocytosis labeled picture, we can see that this brown chunk, which is some sort of thing that can be used as fuel or contains fuel, is at the moment in its own vesicle called a food vacuole. But you have this purple lysosome that I talked about earlier, with its hydrolytic enzymes, which are the dangerous things that need to be kept away from the rest of the cell. It's enclosed by its own membrane, but it's the same material as the membrane of the food vacuole, so the two can fuse together, and that's what brings the food particle in contact with the enzymes that will break it down, digest it safely away from the rest of the cell. Now, basically, the same process is occurring on the right side, but this is called autophagy. Same PHAG part, right, which means eat. What does auto mean? Self. So self-eating. Digesting itself, or part of itself, is what that really means. So instead of bringing in something for the purpose of using it as food, basically, what's happening here is that a mitochondrion that it has seen better days no longer is functioning as a mitochondrion for cellular respiration. It's useless as far as cellular respiration is concerned, but it's made out of valuable materials that can be recycled. So you wrap membrane around it to form more or less a food vacuole like in the other example, expose it to hydrolytic enzymes in a lysosome, and you know, all those raw materials can then be reassembled to make new stuff. Well, 12 isn't really any new information. It just gives you another view of the central vacuole, the cartoon version. But in the real photomicrograph, real picture, it really gives you a sense of just how much of the interior of a cell is occupied by a central vacuole. This is what I was talking about earlier when I said a plant can grow pretty quickly because a lot of its volume doesn't have to be produced. It's just water that it's bringing in. And 13 also isn't really new information. We've talked about the
movement of membrane material from one from one organelle to another. We see that again here. The Golgi cis face is receiving vesicles from the rough endoplasmic reticulum. Brand new vesicles are budding off of the trans face. But here we can actually see that these proteins that are in the vesicle are ones that are going to be totally spilled out of the cell by fusion of the vesicle with the plasma membrane. It's the same material as well. So it will fuse into it, and now what was Golgi material is part of the plasma membrane, and these proteins are exported. So the plasma membrane is not, just like the rest of the cell in general, it is not a unchanging material. It is continuously changing, highly dynamic. Things are added to it, like here. And also, whenever a cell undergoes endocytosis, it takes a little bit of that plasma membrane out of itself. So the contents of the plasma membrane is always changing. All right, 14. Much better view of a mitochondria in here. I've already said that it's a doubly membrane-bounded organelle. You see the outer and inner mitochondrial membranes, but they differ quite a bit. The outer mitochondrial membrane is really just as big as it needs to be to form an outer covering of the whole thing. The inner membrane, though, is actually much bigger, and that's because it is highly folded. And each of these folds of the inner mitochondrial membrane is called a crista, the plural of which is Christi. Why does a mitochondrion have Christi? Why would you have a bunch of folds in the membrane? Any idea? Yeah.
Surface area?
Exactly. Just like a microvillus increases surface area, like I was talking about on the intestinal cells, the inner mitochondrial matrix with its Christi drastically increases surface area, and for the same reason. As we'll see later, the process of cellular respiration, which is what it's occurring in this organelle, requires a lot of proteins that are embedded in membrane. Therefore, the more membrane you have, the more such proteins you can house, and therefore the more processing of fuel can be done to produce a lot of energy, to store it in the form of ATP. Okay, now, since a mitochondrion is doubly membrane-bounded, that means just that organelle by itself is compartmentalized. The cell overall, of course, is compartmentalized, but even the mitochondrion is compartmentalized because there's one compartment that's between the two membranes. And that's why that space is called the intermembrane space, the fluid compartment that's between the two membranes. But then you also have all the stuff that's inside the inner membrane. And that stuff collectively is called the mitochondrial matrix. And another thing you see here is that a mitochondrion has its own ribosomes, which are separate from the ribosomes in the bigger cell that it's part of. And I'll explain why next time, but not shown here is that in addition to having its own ribosomes, mitochondria also have their own DNA, which is separate from the DNA in the nucleus. It's for the same reason, but I'll get into that reason next time. So I'll see you in the laboratory.